will zoom in so we can first have a look at the opportunities and benefits of online guidance. So it gives you the possibility of interacting asynchronously, that's true, an online interaction, and can reach a larger number of students, that's true, you can reach many students at the same time, and it allows you to react immediately to a problem. And this was a very well spotted, that this is both two sides of the same phenomena. So on the as an opportunity, as a good side, it gives you it's easy to contact students online, but then the hindsight is that at least they may contact you even on Sunday. And what we have noticed, students very often, they expect to have a very quick response. So if they may even send you an email like 11 p.m. and then by 9 a.m. the next day they have sent you two emails asking why haven't you already replied them. So yes, this is the two sides of the same idea. And then human technology principles, instead of isolating people, digital products could create more connections. Yes, that's definitely true, and especially now that we are living the situation where we cannot welcome everyone on campus and we cannot see people face to face. And at least here, well, I know it's the same in pretty many places, but here in Jyväskylä, for example, there's a dramatic difference that students have returned to, most of the students have returned to their hometowns because, for example, our university has students all around the country. So now there are so many empty rent apartments because they have simply gone away from Jyväskylä. So this is the only way at the moment to reach for the students. And then as an opportunity, students can reflect on their own learning. Yes. Before we go to the challenges part, would you like to add or comment something or share some of your discussions you were doing in the small groups?
In our group, we were talking that this has helped us, some students, that they don't feel comfortable in class, in face-to-face class, to be talking in the classes online. They know with the camera open, but they feel free to be talking. So has been... this is like the online interacting is not only that you have access to more students, that is the even the same student that your regular students, you are able to interact with them, with some of them, because they close the camera and they start they feel like more comfortable, confident, and they start talking. We were talking about that there's something that the three of us, we have seen that this happened in Palermo and in Spain. We have seen that this happened. For me, it was a surprise, actually, to see that they don't want to open the camera. They don't want to be seen.
Yeah.
But they want to talk. So it was quite weird. For me, it was quite weird. But my colleagues were talking that the same, that they happened the same thing to them, that they wanted to talk, but they didn't want to be seen. So this they has allowed us to interact with some kind of students. They are more shy, or they don't feel so confident, and they feel trust. I don't know. This was quite weird, actually, but. This was a curious thing that the three of us, we have seen the same thing with online.
That's very, very interesting. And this also supports the very general advice that to allow students to choose which interaction channel they want to use if they feel uncomfortable or sharing their webcam, but they can use voice, that's fine. And then there are some students who prefer writing, like chat messages. And then on the other hand, for example, students who are slow writers or have dyslexia, like problems with reading and writing, then they prefer using their voice. So this supports this advice that it's good that students have options, that we don't force them to use web camera, because then they may not dare to say anything. But yes, very, very good points there. And
Okay, sorry for interrupting you. No, because I wanted to say two things. The first one is that they don't want to have the videos open, especially during the exams. And we had a lot of problems with that in the University of Valencia. And the second thing is about what you were mentioning, is that question with people with disabilities, because this way of teaching is much more complicated for them. If they are blind people, they cannot follow. I don't know. I have had some students with some disabilities, and I was wondering myself, how could they follow my lectures when I use these visual contents? Because of course they have materials, and I give them quite a lot of materials, but those materials are not all of the materials I use in during my lessons, and some of them I don't know how to adapt to those people. So it's really complicated, at least for people who has not so much experience.
That is, you are correct, Fernanda, and we are going to talk about this more tomorrow. But I can already say that it is, well, there are some hints, like you said, that you deliver the material for them in advance and maybe have some like options or supporting material. But then yet still we know that some disciplines, like for example, like mathematical sciences, they are very hard to approach if you cannot see, because it is just too difficult. You can handle more information visually than by hearing and trying to remember if you have a screen reader, like a program reading aloud the text, and with all these mathematical very, very long sentences that you have to go through, it is hard. And Fred, please go ahead.
Just to say that I think digital is also an opportunity for people with disabilities. I was working with blind and visually impaired kids before I worked at the university. And so I was adapting their books for school and for personal reading. And only 8% of books are adapted or accessible to visually impaired kids. This is why the organizations of those people are asking book publisher to do a lot of digital things like e-books or EPUBs. This actually comes from their initiative in a way. And I think also for people in wheelchairs, I worked a little with, I've seen some of them. In the physical world, it's very hard to know if you're going to have an obstacle to go to your classroom. So in this way, in this matter, technology can also be an asset, because we have all the, as developer coders, we have many standards to try to have accessible products. So in the digital world, these questions are essential. Of course, a lot needs to be done, but we are further away than in the physical world, I would say, because it's easier to make things accessible than in the real world, I think.
Thank you, Fred. Very, very valuable experiences that you are sharing. And digital world can be, depending on the type of special educational need or disability, it may provide more or like new opportunities for disabled students to participate in higher education studies. But if the accessibility issues are not considered, it can really be a showstopper for their studies, so they just cannot proceed. And please, Renato, go ahead.
Thank you. As for the the choice of channels, I tend to agree with you that we should let our students choose the preferred channel to communicate with us. It is inside the world trust idea. I mean, I trust you to use the best channel for you. Still, some of my colleagues, and this is something I want to reflect about. Some of my colleagues, I hear that they ask them their student to switch on the webcams during the lectures. Maybe if they have too many students, they ask 10 or 15 of them randomly choose to switch the webcams on. So at least they have some kind of visual feedback from the classroom. I do understand these because I really miss it when I am online. But at the same time, I fear that can be very stressful for the students, especially because they are just 10 or 15 of them. So they have been singled out, you know, in the herd. They have been chosen. You have to show your webcam, and all the others are not. So I don't think in the end, I do understand the need for feedback because I really need it. But in the end, I fear this could be not a so good choice for our students. So yeah, I tend to let them choose which channel. But as Giuseppe also pointed out in chat, in Palermo, students are required to have their camera on during an exam. Actually, we have very tough rules about it. We can, you know, ask them to show the room and to do a lot of things. It's very, even too much aggressive on them. But of course, it's something we feel could be a problem in testing. But as far as I experienced during the exams in the past year, it's more a problem of how do you plan your exam, how you design it. And if you're clever enough, it's really difficult for them to make some, to cheat. And most of them, they too scared to cheat anyway. And if some of them they are so good, they're going to cheat anyhow, okay, they deserve to pass because that's something, you know, they are doing something very good after my whole barrier not to cheat. If they succeed, okay, they deserve it. Okay.
This is interesting, and this is leading very nicely us towards the other topic we're going to shift in about 15 minutes to the assessment. And this is, if we think about the face-to-face situation in an auditorium, then the teacher can see each and everyone's face and nobody thinks it's a problem. But if it's done digitally and you kind of force students to do it, then it may be an issue. And I can understand the stress of students, especially those if they have some social issues, like they're shy or really anxious of social interaction situation, and then they have they are unlucky in this lottery of who has to share webcam there. And yes, this is as checking the chat messages. This is also interesting cultural difference that in Finland, the starting point is that we trust in the student. Someone might call us naive, but that's kind of very basic value in northern countries that, the starting point is that we trust students. But as I was working in this, European, Horizon 2020 project where we were developing a system for online studies and to kind of detect the authorship, authentication and authorship. So all the Spanish partners were laughing at us naive northern universities. And then there's Fred is raising up that there's also these proctoring softwares, but it's costly, yes, and somehow controversial. Yes, that's true. Even though disabled students or students living far away can really benefit from it for their exams. And this is exactly something that I have been doing research for my own PhD studies of this system that I just mentioned, and we even had one paper on specifically of students with special educational needs and disabilities and e-proctoring. And yes, this is something that I can say that also students can be very sensitive about. They are sensitive of their privacy. They have like privacy concerns, and especially if they have some disability issues, it may be very distracting for them to be asked to share a video recording of your face, for example. And there's this digital situation, as this chat discussion reveals, it offers various opportunities for cheating. And then there's this good connection to the assessment topic that we'll be dealing later today, that how to make assessment transparent already during the course, so it's not just the final exams, and how to make sure that it's students' own work and not someone else's. Yes, and that's, yeah, very good point. I think we will go quickly through these challenges and technical issues, and then actually continue with the assessment topic, because this really goes to the core ideas of how to build assessment on the course. And we'll get back to these chat messages as well. But here, the challenges in online guidance is that it demands you to be active in communication. It's time consuming. Depending on the platforms, you may have to use certain providers. And then, of course, teachers and students' digital competences. And I think this was a very topical issue a year ago when we had to jump to this digital and online mode also in courses and guidance that was previously done face-to-face. So there was no time to train and think and practice, but we had to jump directly to online mode. And then let's have a look at these tools, and we'll get back to the chat messages as well. Technical or pedagogical tools mentioned here are student-managed tutoring, student mentoring. Yes, students are good in this. We also have this, I think many of you, but we also have this very good network of student tutors, and they get paid for certain a number of hours, and it's especially in the beginning of the first year student studies, it's a very, very, very valuable network, and they are sharing all the experience they have. So PowerPoint presentations, Word files, sharing short videos and web materials. Yes, this is a good point. It doesn't always have to be interactive. So we often think that guidance and counseling is always synchronous and interactive in both ways, but you can also do a lot of guiding materials. And so questionnaires and polls online, Microsoft Teams, Moodle, YouTube, mentoring, Jyväskylä University goodies mentioned here as well. We will share you the link to the English webpage of which tells more about this student life project and these goodies and video tutorials. And this wonder.me was new to me. This was interesting. I had a short look at it during the break. Would someone like to share us what you have been doing it? I can open the web page here, but I didn't do anything there, but this was new system to me.
Yeah, I think can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay, good. Because my headset's just a little off. We were talking about this in my group, and it's a video conference tool, but it works a little differently from Zoom and from all the others, because not you as a teacher are, I mean, you're still kind of in control about the on the room, off the room. My God, it's been a long break. Off the room, but you have like little bubbles. So if the students enter the room, they are little bubbles, and if these bubbles get together, they form their own room. So pretty much it means that the students themselves can choose who they want to talk to in the room. It's not automatically that you are the one saying, okay, you are in a group and you work together, but they can decide themselves. And they are very flexible in this. It's really nice. We are not allowed to use it. I wanted to try with my students and we are not allowed, but it is GDPR conform. So maybe some of you would like to try it. And I just, because I think it's a really cool tool and I thought maybe others can make use of it.
Just a question, because we talked about mm-hmm. this in the group, but do you have an open room we can see? So
yeah, sure. Yeah. We can try this maybe later.
This would be actually interesting. Yeah. And yeah. I want to ask, why were you not allowed to use it? Because you said it that it was GDPR proof, because that would have been my first concern.
It says on their page, and I think even someone, I was in such a show room with some people from this organization, from the startup. It's in Berlin, the startup. And I talked to them and I was listening, and somebody, I think, even asked about it, and they were like, yeah, it is. It's fine. The servers are all in Europe, so it all goes under this GDPR. But my university, so I asked about this because I really wanted to use it. And my university is very strict about these kind of things. And we are only allowed, and really only allowed, to use MS Teams and a video conference platform, which is called Big Blue Button.
And the question, and there's a question in the chat. How much it cost?
Right now it's for free. Right now you can use it for free. And it will start costing money next year in January. So I think because they are a startup, of course, now they want to advertise this.
Oh, cute.
And it's going to start. But, and that's the nice thing, if you now create the rooms are still going to be free. So if you create now 20 rooms, they will still be there in January and they will still be for free. And you can use them infinitely.
And so where's the catch? Really,
maybe because you start paying in January then, like, to use it. And maybe if you use it professionally, maybe at some point you want to do this. But yeah, you should have rooms now. Yeah. No, then that's the nice thing also. You are, as the teacher, as the creator of the room, you are the only one giving your email address. And that's it. They don't ask for anything more. And they also, your students get a link. And you click on the link, they go into the room. They don't leave anything there.
Okay, because
Maybe there's a catch somewhere. I couldn't detect it. I haven't detected it yet. But as I said, I'm not allowed to use it. So, yeah. But maybe you are, and you can spread the word. And maybe at some point, like in 4 or 5 years, I'm allowed to use it too. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. And Renato, please, do you have a question or comment?
As we discussed it in my group, and so this maybe is connected to this. There is for me. At least one of the key points in this online engagement and this online teaching and so on is the problem of the so-called provider lock-in. I put this on the challenges in the whiteboard. Because the problem is that we as institutions, as public institutions, are somehow outsourcing part of our way of teaching to private companies. Mm-hmm. And this is okay. I mean, we are paying for a service, that's okay. But the problem is that we are not just, you know, buying a desk or a computer or some other kind of stuff. We are going to be locked in the platform we are using. Because, for example, in my university, we started using Teams because we were in a hurry. We had infrastructure for video conferencing at this level and so on. So we also, most of my colleagues now are learning to use Teams. It was an effort for them. So they are okay with Teams. Okay, we don't want to change. And all our courses are moving on Teams and then all the materials and on and on. The problem is in the future, you won't be able to switch to another provider because this is a one provider for this service. It's not something like Moodle. You can have in-house Moodle, or you can have an external provider for Moodle, stuff like this. And this is something I'm really, really scary of, because we are locking in without too much reflection on it, because we are in a hurry, because there was the pandemic, we have to do this, we have to do that, and so on. But now For example, most of the schools in Italy, they chose Google School platform, Google Meet and Classroom. Most of the universities, they chose Microsoft Teams. But in both the cases, apart of the GDPR compliance, there's a problem of being locked in a specific service. Like this is true also for Kahoot or for WonderMe or for any commercial service that is one of a kind. So I think we as teachers, we should reflect more on trying to choose open source or free services, not just for the sake of it, but because it gives us much more liberty in the future to switch different provider, to different tools, to export and import back our data, our materials, course, and so on. This is something that I must say it's not very much discussed, at least in my university, but also in other gatherings, in other discussion groups. But it is crucial because in the next 10 years, we are going to move a lot of our teaching on digital platforms. And the medium, it actually makes a big difference.
I strongly agree with you, Renata. And we in our university, we have a strong commitment to open source software and have been producing it and using as much as possible. But it's not always easy to choose. Or there may be vendors that you only have to buy commercial software. But please, Fred, you have something to comment here. Go ahead.
Yeah, just to comment, open source software as sovereign digital tools is an illusion. Because do you have open source hardware? No, you have Juniper, Cisco, Intel, AMD, they're all US. And now Google is doing his own chip. They are starting to build their own hardware. And Microsoft is going to do the same. So basically, you can think you're free because you have open source, but you're not, because the whole internet architecture is based on these companies. It's not open source companies.
That's correct. That's very. That's how it goes when we are being realistic. Yes, and then Beatrice, go ahead, and then I think we can softly start shifting to assessment. Yeah.
Very short, because I know that. But a thing that we really worry about is not just is data protection, not only our emails. All the information the faculties have, I mean, in Spain, there are two faculties that they give the emails and the information about their students to other companies. But if you send, by online researchers, you are vulnerable to, they have access to the information of our students, we can't forget that information is very important for the companies. Facebook has been, I mean, there are some cases already, but teachers, for example, we can't forget that we hold and manage a really very vulnerable information, important information, that is the name, the email, the age, and so many information of our students. So when we open that information in a space, even if we're creating YouTube, that they ask as a teacher, they ask the faculty, ask upload, give to your student upload in YouTube. I say no, I don't want to do it because I don't want that some information about. So I don't want to be online. I don't want to be, but they ask us to share some information that is not academic information, but not only for us as the teachers, but only, not only our information, but also we handle a student's information. So we have to pay attention to that. So to upload the emails of our students, to create, I mean, for me, like as a lawyer, I mean, like it's a risk, a terrible risk. And the other point about, for example, materials, there's another copyright. That's why some of my colleagues didn't want to upload some materials online, because some of our students have used it to use to some friends they were preparing to be a civil servant. They using the materials we were giving us to our students to prepare another, like to be a civil servant or to be a judge. We have prepared the material for them, and then they have tell them to upload that in the class for your students. But after that, the student can use it whatever. So there are so many. I mean, online is very good, but there's data protection, but also copyright, the intellectual property about the materials we upload. And there's things that in Spain, at least, we are very worried about.
That's true. And I agree that we really should. That's why I asked the first question of the Wonder Me was, what's the catch? Because I always think there is no free lunch. And you also raised up a very important issue, copyright, because that's sometimes hard for teachers to understand that once they upload something to, even if it's a password protected environment like Moodle or something, they cannot really control what happens to the material after that. If the students download it and then upload it to somewhere else, then you can't really control it. Or we have already some cases of kind of digital bullying when students record sessions or share screenshots of virtual lessons and issues like this, which is very, very highly unethical. But because we cannot really prevent that, there is no way to do it. I can say that you're not allowed to record it, but then they take their mobile phone and record the screen and the voice, and that's it. Yes. Yeah. Thank you. That was very, very good speech, because there are very many legal issues in this digital world that may not have really being the same kind of concern when we are teaching face to face. So very, very good. So thank you. I think this has been very interesting discussion, and we have found new tools, and we can continue the discussion. I will switch the microphone to my colleague Lisa, who will continue with the assessment. And I think this was very nicely going from guidance to assessment, because we were already discussing about this. How to cheat in the final exam if you're only having a final exam and the problems in the digital world. So please go ahead, Lisa.
Yes, thank you, Maria. I'll share the okay. Maybe I'll stop my video to make sure that my internet is okay. So from guidance and counseling to assessment, and I have to add to what Maria said, that we Finns are very, trust our students to be honest and stuff like that. But about a year ago, with the first lockdown, I was in a seminar or a webinar where there was a lot of discussion about exams, how we now organize our exams, because the campuses were closed and exams had to be taken also quickly online. And the main concern of the teachers seemed to be how to make sure, or how to supervise the students when they do their exams, or how to proctor them. And then of course some teachers thought that okay, is this your main concern? Shouldn't your main concern be that how do they are they learning what they are supposed to learn and stuff like that? And then one teacher ended the discussion by saying that okay, no matter what kind of supervision methods or tools or proctoring tools we use, they'll cheat anyway. So that was kind of the closing point of that discussion. But so let's go to assessment. First, something about kind of a background to this to our discussions about assessment guidelines or criteria. Where do you start? Of course, the official guidelines or criteria always come from your organizational guidelines. We all have our universities, we all have degree statutes that state something about teaching and assessing and degrees and guidelines and criteria for those. And then of course we have our pedagogical guidelines, and they come from our curriculum planning. For example, in our university, our curriculum is like we go in a 3-year circle, so our curriculum is valid for 3 years, and then we check the curriculum and plan it again. And in our curriculum, there are the learning goals are determined for each study modules, and also then from the learning goals and from the curriculum planning, when we go to the course design, then we need to plan the learning activities that are planned according to these learning goals. A few years ago, when our curriculum was revised, we did, our university teachers did a big work in determining core competencies for each course, for example. So for each course, they were determined what the student has to know, or what the student is supposed to learn, so that each course was described like, after this course, the student can da-da-da, and then they were listed all the core competencies that have to be met during this course. And that was quite a big work that the teachers and the departments did in the curriculum work. Then of course we need to, when we design our courses and we plan our teaching, we need to think about what do we want to assess. I just listened to a webinar in the autumn where one colleague said, I think it was rather well put, that we need to, or the students need to be able to leave footprints of learning, so that there has to be activities where the student can show what they can and what they know and show their knowledge. So they, when they leave these footprints, then I have some evidence as a teacher where what I can evaluate and what I can assess. If they don't leave any footprints of learning, then how can I assess their learning? And then of course, we need to think, who does the assessment? Is it always the teacher only who assesses what the students are learning? Do I want to use self-assessment as well, or peer assessment? Is it possible that the students assess their work? Or can I use group assessment? And then, of course, how do we assess? And we have to remember that assessment is not just giving grades. And here, when we talk about assessment, we always come to the question of formative versus summative assessment. So that someone put it quite well, that you get what you order, so that when you design your learning activities in your course, and what kind of assessment you use, it influences the way the students learn or what the students do in your course. So for example, if they know that there is going to be a final exam of 100 multiple choice questions asking details, then the student learns these details by heart. But after the course, do they understand the whole concept, for example, of your course, and can they adapt their knowledge to other things as well? So that's something maybe to think about when you design your courses and you design your learning activities and you design the assessment that you're going to use. So when you design the assessment that you are going to use, you need to identify and evaluate the learning objectives. What are the key skills and the knowledge that the students are expected to gain on your course? So we go again back to the core competencies, if you like. And when you design your teaching, are some learning objectives more valuable, or do they matter more than others? For example, we can compare these core competencies that the students is supposed to learn in your course, but then again, there's always these transferable skills that they learn by on the side of the content. For example, they learn how to do group work, they learn how to work in teams, they learn how to write reports or whatever. So that's something that comes on the side of the content of your course and the core competencies. But do you want to pass these transferable skills, or do you assess also them, or is it just the core competencies that you assess, and these are only the things that matter in the final mark or the final grade? And then, of course, it could be useful to use different assessment methods, but as with all renovations, maybe it's wise to use them or innovative methods on a small scale, so that you don't turn your teaching and your assessment methods and criteria all upside down at once, so that you maybe try something new and see how it goes and develop them then over time. One slide about this formative and summative assessment. As you as teachers know, the summative assessment can be seen as more as ranking or putting students in order and the grading at the end, and everything that you do with your course is just targeted to this final grading. Whereas formative then it's the assessment goes, or the evaluation is there during the whole learning process and during the whole course, and you give feedback. And someone put it quite well that, are you looking back or looking forward? So for example, or we can think that in summative, you are giving feedback, so you are looking back, whereas you should be looking forward when you give feedback. So where the student is now and what he or she has learned already and what he or she has to do to get forward with this. I added this slide from the DCOMP EDU framework. This is what this framework says about assessment. Of course, this digital competence framework the starting point is in digital tools and using digital technologies, because it's about the digital competences. So but we can see that also here, the framework states that there are these three stages. You need to use your assessment strategies and analyze evidence. So here as well, there are the footprints of learning that you can then analyze and assess according to them. And of course, the main point is to give feedback and do the planning. And within this framework, of course, the good tools then to give the feedback or do the assessment. Okay, before we go to group discussion, this was a short introduction into the assessment. Any questions or comments so far?
No, thank you. No, not in my case, at least.
No.
All clear.
I think so. I think, well, there are many comments that we can do, but I guess that is more for the
further discussion.
Next time.
Yes. Okay. It's 10 to 2 now. Should we have a short break now and then go to the, when we come back, go to the breakout rooms and to the discussion? How do you feel?
Sure. Okay, yes, sure.
Like 5 minutes?
Perfect.
Yes, okay. Let's come back like 5 minutes and then we'll continue with the group work.
Okay, see you soon. See you then, I mean. Bye.
Okay. Are we back already?
Yes.
Yes, here we are again.
Here we are. Okay. So what we are going to do next is that we are going to, I'll share the slideshow again. Just a minute. Here. So this is what we do. I'm going to divide you into breakouts again. And there's another flinger again. So to have you discuss about assessment in this breakout rooms. And these are the questions or themes for you. So what type of assessment do you use? And could it be developed? Would it need to be developed? How do you feel? And then you can discuss about the challenges of assessment in online teaching. And also how did you change your assessment? Did you have to change your assessment methods due to pandemic and when you had to change your teaching maybe to online? So these